spend 50 minutes in the company of our guest in this show, and it's like a spa for the mind. Jonas Riddarstrand is one of the world's most exciting business thinkers. He gives us his reflections on COVID and how leaders can avoid being paralyzed by data as things change, how to combine decisive action with emotional conviction.
Hi, folks. Welcome to The Evolving Leader. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes. How are you feeling today, Scott?
I'm feeling good. It's a sunny Monday, an unusual day for us to be recording, but kind of a fun way to start the week. How are you feeling?
Feeling very cold. It's crazy. The air conditioning's gone mad in our office, so it's like minus God knows what. It's boiling outside. But in my heart, I'm feeling uplifted after England won its first opener in the 2020 games. Uh-huh. Although I'm not the greatest football fan of all time, not like our guest.
Are you allowed not to be a football fan in England? Don't you have to be? Isn't that a requirement of citizenship?
I am a football fan, but I'm not. I'm not crazy football fan. I don't go to the pub to watch the games, and you know, spend my waking hours worrying about goal differences and things like that. But other than that, I'm feeling really good.
So let me set out today's agenda. 20 years ago, our guest shook up the concept of the business book and the speaker circuit with his colleague, Kjell Nordstrøm. The book, Funky Business, and its sequels remain some of the most successful business books of all time. With highly stylized prose, they brought a new way of unlocking ideas about the digital economy that was transferring power to the customer. They looked across at how culture, music, and the arts, and the changes they brought to society, interact with business. No one then, outside the social sciences, was thinking that way, and certainly not bringing it to business audiences. Their conference slots also defied expectations of what a business professor should look and sound like. They were tightly choreographed shows with precise scripts. I remember one of their appearances for a government think tank in London, featuring an entrance to the then Pope's rapping CD. Shaven heads, biker jackets, and provocative and beautiful PowerPoints. They brought something entirely new to the scene, punk rock attitude with Swedish cool. So, without any further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Professor Jonas Riddarstrand. Welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thank you so much. I'm blushing now after that introduction. Yeah. Swedes blush easily.
Well, welcome, Jonas. Thank you for coming on. Before we get started, I think I have to ask a really important question. Are you still rocking the leather jacket when you go out?
On occasion. I guess I had a dream when I was really young to become a professional football player, but I realized that I was born with my right foot on my left leg, so I can't play. And then I wanted to become a rock star, but quickly realized that I was also born with mittens on my hands. So I guess all the stuff I'm doing now is kind of a revenge of the nerds. But I did actually buy, right before the pandemic hit us, a new electric guitar. So I'm practicing, but I don't have the fingers anymore. And when I was young, I formed a punk band, but I was kicked out of my own band after 3 weeks. If you're kicked out of the punk band, you're really, really bad.
Why were you kicked out? Was it because you were really bad or you just had a bad attitude?
You're supposed to have a bad attitude.
Or perhaps I lack the managerial skills, and that's why I ended up being an academic.
So, Jonas, can we start with a little of your background and why you wrote Funky Business?
Well, right after I'd finished my doctoral dissertation, which took about 8 years to write and sold 15 copies, where I probably bought 12 for my family, I'd been doing in parallel quite a bit of executive teaching at the Stockholm School of Economics, where I resided back then. And together with my colleague, Kjell, we had developed a couple of lectures, introductory lectures for each module in the advanced management program of the school. And we had started to get requests from outside the school's executive development programs to do Christmas speeches for the customers of clients. And it turned out that those became very popular to the extent that the school said, we can't handle all the phone calls that we get with requests. And Kjell, who had started doing it a couple of years before I got involved, he had been approached by a woman who wanted to become his agent. And I hooked up and she became my agent too. And as it turned out, her husband, who was a former co-CEO of SAS, the Swedish, the Scandinavian airline company, he had nurtured a dream already since he was a young boy to become a publisher. So he approached us and said, why don't you take your lectures and turn them into a book? And we said, no way. Because we knew what 8 years of painful writing meant. But he sort of threatened and cajoled us into putting it together into a manuscript. And then we got involved with a guy called Stuart Craner, an English guy who basically edits business books. And he collaborated with us on writing Funky Business, polishing it. I mean, to my astonishment, I mean, my previous book had sold 13 copies or whatever it was, and it took 8 years. And here was a book that took, it basically wrote itself because it was the lectures and some add-ons. So I guess the writing took about half a year, and then suddenly it sold close to 500,000 copies. So it's, I mean, life is weird, but it took 8 years of practicing to get there, so to speak.
Well, it's not unfair to say that it was transformational, because I remember picking a copy of the book in London, and it stood out from everything else that was there at the time. And I then got everybody at our company a copy of it that day, because I read it on the train on the way home, and I thought, this is really amazing. And it was talking about all the things that we were experiencing, but nobody was really articulating it. And then clients started talking about it, and you were everywhere, at every conference platform. You were getting voted as the most successful speakers, and et cetera, et cetera. And it all kind of exploded very, very quickly. You seem to be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and some weird things happened. I remember this must have been probably about a month or so after the book came out in the UK. I was doing a presentation in London, and I got to Heathrow, the airport. And I walked into the British Airways in-flight lounge, and on the wall, they had covers of the British Airways magazine. And I didn't know it, but Shell and I was on the cover. And it was kind of embarrassing for a Swede. I told you, we blush easily, to have like 150 copies with your picture on it. As you walked in, so I just immediately picked up one of the dailies and hid myself behind it. Now it was transformational, but we started to want to write a book for those who had not necessarily spent their entire life in the business library. We wanted to write a book that you should be able to finish on a transatlantic flight, a sort of book that you couldn't and didn't want to put down once you had opened it. And in order to do that, you needed to use examples that make sense to most people, not only those who have read every business book already. So for us, it made sense to use examples from sports, from music, from the art world, but also business examples, of course. And why did we do it? I think in part because we realized more so than most other people, given that we're both Swedes, that the welfare state that both Shell and I grew up in had been dismantled. I mean, we had our own Reaganomics, Thatcherism kind of development in Sweden. And so many responsibilities had basically ended up in your own lap. And for us, writing the book was an effort really to arm people with the most lethal competitive weapon of that economy, namely knowledge, because you had to inform yourself before you made decisions that affected your life, decisions that historically had been taken by the state or by the church or by your parents.
So let's stay with Funky Business a minute longer, because it was, as you say, a juxtaposition of opposites. Businesses, by and large, business wasn't funky, but formal. It was often boring and uncreative. So how did you specifically approach this challenge, and is business funkier now?
Well, I think we approached it by developing something that we call the phantom profile. A phantom profile is something that you typically do in order to find a criminal. So we had, when our prime minister, Olof Palme, was born, given all the statements from people who had been in the vicinity of the place where he was killed, they created a phantom profile that became known as the profile of a 43-year-old man, And we started collecting bits and pieces of information in order to eventually produce a phantom profile of what a potential future firm could look like. And I think towards the end, before writing Funky Business, we probably had about 5,000 or 6,000 post-it notes. And those post-it notes, we started to, is this about societal developments or is it about the firm? Is it about strategy? So we started to try to figure out this jigsaw puzzle, basically, of bits and pieces of information. So it was a bit Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson-like kind of detective work. And most of that stuff was based on reading lots and lots and lots of articles in the usual suspects like Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, but also reading Rolling Stone magazine and a wide variety of different magazines, but also, of course, based on the fact that we did a lot of work with companies as consultants, as advisors, as speakers, and also in our research. And I think to some extent we were lucky because many of the things that you today associate with modern management, you could find in Scandinavia a lot earlier than that, because most Scandinavian firms went international early on. So while for many American multinationals back then, the rest of the world equaled almost nothing, for many Swedish firms, 2 years into the internationalization process, you have a subsidiary in Germany that is bigger than headquarters back home in Sweden. So I think we were at the right place at the right time. I think we also had great ambitions. And I think there's something to be said about that. I mean, there is something like economies of ambitions. If you don't have the ambitions, you will never, ever, unless you're extremely lucky, succeed. But I think that in a nutshell explains why we wrote a book like Funky Business.
So let's come back to the present. A few years ago, you wrote another great book, this time with Julian Birkinshaw, a professor of entrepreneurship at the London Business School, called Fast Forward, Make Your Company Fit with the Future. At the heart of that is the message that many organizations are approaching growth opportunities wrong, and need to combine what you call decisive action with emotional conviction to prevent stalling over analysis. So where did you come to arrive at that real simplicity of, you know, what's the problem of being stalled by staring in the face of too much data?
A couple of observations. The first one, I think, I listened to a Microsoft executive at a conference perhaps 10 years ago, and he made the argument, which we then borrowed in the book, that everyone on our planet is gradually becoming a little bit more stupid. Well, there's sort of good news and bad news here. The good news is that actually we are becoming a little bit more intelligent as individuals. I mean, there is a lot of research suggesting that over a 10-year time period, average individual IQ increases by about 3 IQ points. And we don't know why it's happening, but we can see it more or less all over the world where we have statistics for IQ. But if that is the good news, the bad news is, of course, that knowledge on the overall societal level is growing at a much faster pace. So while individual knowledge is growing at a linear rate, societal knowledge, what we know, what mankind knows, all the stuff you find on the internet, that is growing at an exponential rate. So there's this growing gap between what I know and what we know. Or to put it differently, we're all becoming increasingly stupid, relatively speaking. That was the first piece of information that made me started to think about what does that mean for organizations? Well, it means that you have to collaborate. What does it mean for hierarchies? Well, it means that you cannot really put your trust in a single individual or a very small group of individuals at the very top of organizations. So teamwork inside and outside organizations. I guess that was the first big idea. The second big idea has to do with complexity and how we have created this connected world. And I think initially all the connections made us think that this would be a much more predictable world because we are so extremely connected technologically, physically, politically, economically, it's one big spider's web. But I think the event of the financial crisis, the event of the swine flu, and now just recently the pandemic, rather points to the fact that the more we connect, the less we can predict. And that's one of the disadvantages of living in this very connected economy. It becomes fragile. And if you put those two observations together, we are becoming increasingly stupid and the world is becoming increasingly complex. You're left in a world in which belief becomes much more important, because when man no longer knows, man is forced to believe. And we've seen a plethora of examples of that too during the recent years. I mean, no one has been able to agree on the best strategy for dealing with the pandemic. I mean, I live in a country that has been using, I think, an outlier kind of strategy compared to the lockdowns you've seen in most European countries. But the old strategies are claimed to be based on the scientific truths. So apparently science can't agree. If you look at Brexit, belief. If you look at Trump, belief. So while I think we most certainly in Funky Business believed that the internet and digitization in general would create a society in which facts ruled, I think we've been proven wrong, and in not in a small way during the last decade or so. So all that was sort of the background. How do you deal with a company when you cannot really rely on bureaucracy anymore because the knowledge world is way too complex for that to work? Can you rely on a meritocracy? Well, I spent 20 years of my life in a meritocracy, a business school, and we're really good at talking, but nothing ever happens. So there are limits to what you can do with a meritocracy. And the idea we started to dig into, me and Julian, is how do you build an organization if action becomes paramount? If you cannot plan, if you cannot forecast, or at least it makes less and less sense to do so. So it was a very sort of action-oriented organization, but it also needs to be backed by emotional conviction, because without that, you will not get access to that 10, 15% extra that we can all give, but that we're willing to give only when we're 100% committed to something.
This is really interesting to me. So let's dig into emotional conviction a little bit more. So, you know, in some of the, I do a lot of emotional intelligence coaching, and some of the work that I do with leaders, I often find that I'm challenging the person I'm working with to connect with a form of their intelligence that they might be repressing. So in some cases, they need to connect more with their feelings. They're sort of like the heart intelligence, right? In some cases, they really need to connect more with their rational thought process. And in many cases, I find that they need to connect more with their sort of gut, their intuition, that sort of conviction part of themselves. So this is really compelling. And I'd love for you to comment on how do we normalize intuition as a driver of agility and rapid decision making when so many cultures are fear and risk adverse. So we need to bring, if I'm hearing you correctly, we need to bring more humanism into our decision making. How do we get better at doing that?
Let me see if I can provide one micro answer and one macro answer. The micro answer to me boils down to the last competitive advantage of man. Because as AI, machine learning starts to improve, you have to think about what role will human beings play, if any, in organizations. And I do believe that there are certain things that still the computers can't do. I mean, they're poor at understanding context. So for instance, I guess many of us Friday evening have encountered a situation where you're being asked, honey, do I look fat in this one? And you're supposed to say, no, you look fabulous, because that's the answer I would like when I ask that question. But what will the computer say? The computer will say, well, according to the statistics, compared to 35% of the population in Sweden, you are extremely obese. Or at least there's a risk, because it doesn't understand the context and how sometimes you need to use white lies. The computer doesn't understand generosity. spontaneity, all the stuff that at the end of the day makes us human. And if we don't start exploiting that last competitive advantage, namely that we do understand emotions and context, I can't see why we shouldn't be replaced by computers. So that would be my sort of micro answer. The macro answer is, I think, some people in some organizations certainly understand how to get emotional conviction. And to me, it starts with having a dream. Without a dream, there will be no emotional connection. And I think there were solid reasons for why Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once upon a time said, "I have a dream," and why he decided not to say, "I have a 5-year plan." Mm-hmm. I mean, 5-year plans don't evoke the kind of emotional response that you want in an organization where you are competing with the best of the best of the best from a knowledge point of view. So that temporary monopoly that we could have maybe during the 80s and 90s as Western organizations, that temporary monopoly based on superior access to intellectual capital, that is gone. And for natural reasons, then the frontier of competitiveness moves.
So what I'm feeling when I hear this idea of trying to combine these two aspects together is the voice of fear in the organization when you say emotional conviction, which basically is a leap of faith. And you've got the highly rational people have been trained over years and years and been rewarded and paid and recruited for that to do exactly this, which is to de-risk everything in the organization. And we are, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right, because it is risky to have a position. I mean, think about the United States of America and why has the U.S. been so incredibly successful economically during the previous century? And I think to me, it boils down to the fact that the United States of America is not a country in the traditional sense, like Sweden or Norway or the UK or Belgium. No, the U.S. is an idea as expressed in the American Constitution. And attached to that idea, you find a dream called the American Dream. And what is so remarkable about that is the fact that we can all become Americans. No matter mm-hmm. where you're born, you can become American. It may take a couple of years, but it's possible. It's a club. It's a movement. You can join it. Let me tell you, it takes 227 years to become Swedish. If you're born in Denmark, for you guys, it would take a little bit longer than that. Since you have the American dream, certain people will love it. Others will loathe it. That's the risk you take when you create a dream that is bold enough and big enough. You will get both reactions. I mean, many people have, I guess, if they're in their 20s right now, ended up late Friday, Saturday evening after a few bottles of red wine on a very heated debate on the topic of United States of America. You need to drink a lot of red wine before you have a similar debate on Holland, because Holland doesn't have a dream, or at least it's not been articulated the way in which the American dream has. And I think historically for companies, it made more sense not to have a position, because the human beings that you employed, and back then they actually employed them, they were not in the gig economy. They were small, replaceable cogs in a big machinery. So small jobs for big organizations, small people. But today, when you differentiate your organization so very much with the kind of people that you attract, you also need to provide them not only with a transactional deal, it needs to be an emotional deal where they will require you to co-create their identity. And then, of course, your organization needs an identity.
So you're sitting in front of the CEO who's in an industry that where the pace of change is engulfing them. They've got a monopoly that is no longer there anymore, but they've still got momentum and success. They've got a workforce of thousands, tens of thousands of people who have been hired to do something that is no longer particularly relevant. And you're asking now to completely changed the nature of how they think as an organization in terms of, you know, stepping out into this area of uncertainty. What would be your advice beyond formulating the dream as the first steps to the CEO to kind of walk down this path?
Get rid of half of all the people, but be sure that it's the right half. And it's probably not the half you're thinking to get rid of right now.
So say more about that. How would you find those?
I think without the fiery spirits on board, and I do believe that you change an organization not overnight. I think it's a long and painful process for the organizations that do this, but it can be done. But instead of using 80% of your energy trying to convince the perhaps 80% of the people who don't believe change is necessary, spend 80% of your energy getting the 20% on board who's already halfway on board. That would be my advice. And also, I think great CEOs know when to kick the habit. Perhaps as a CEO, you have to settle for being the vanilla ice of the company. I mean, you're a one-hit wonder. You had one trick. You're a one-trick pony, and that's what you did. But if you're a great CEO, you know when to kick that habit and hand things over to someone else who's better prepared for doing what is necessary and needed in the organization right now. And there's no shame in doing that. I mean, not everyone is an expert when it comes to the decathlon that leadership really is.
Just getting a little bit more into the detail here. How do you know when you have enough information and when you need to switch from analysis to sense-making and decision-making?
You don't. I think that is also taking a leap of faith. But right now it's so evident, I think, that the ease of getting an additional piece of information basically triggers people not to stop collecting information because it's so easy. I mean, one thing I'm thinking about is when I was young, and I'm turning 55 this summer. When I was young, if my parents had asked me, how far is it from our planet to the moon? How long would it have taken me to find the answer to that question? Well, if it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, I could have jumped on my bike, biked all the way to the library where I lived. It was like a 15-minute biking trip. Then I had to go into the library, try to find a book about the planetary system, and maybe with the help of a librarian, I would find one, find the answer, bike back, and tell my parents, now I know. How long does it take for a kid today? It takes about 7 seconds. It takes me 12 because I'm slow using my thumbs on my phone. And that, I think, completely changes the game. I mean, for instance, how do you expect people that age to sit down with their boss doing the yearly performance review when they're used to getting 7-second feedback every day, every hour, every minute? But there is also a danger with that, because while you can get access to all that information, information is not wisdom. I mean, it's not even knowledge, perhaps, unless you have the capacity to decipher it. And to me, intuition is compressed expertise. I mean, intuition is not some a juju board or astrology. Intuition is exactly that you've encountered this so many times that tacitly you know how to deal with it. Maybe you can't even articulate it. So intuition is what I think exists between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. They intuitively know that now this is going to happen. And they probably can't explain it to a guitarist who may be a much better guitarist than Keith Richards, because it's built on this social relationship that have evolved over decades of spending so much time together. So you will never know exactly when to stop. In all likelihood, you will stop when you realize that your competitor has already done what you were supposed to have done a month ago, or someone who came from way outside the industry and was called Elon Musk and just did it while the rest of the guys were collecting more and more information about maybe, possibly, perhaps this could sometime in the future mean something. So I'm not suggesting that we build organizations that necessarily take more risk, but what I am suggesting is, if you want innovation to happen, you must make it less risky for people to take risk. So when you start to work with intuition, expert, and emotions and conviction, you also have to start thinking about, how do we deal with mistakes? What happens in our organization when we fail? And unless you're capable of building this atmosphere with a lot of tolerance, you will not see innovation happen. If you kill all the negative surprises, you are not going to become the surprise shocker of your industry.
Here on The Evolving Leader, we are committed to stretching the leadership conversation in every episode, and we invite you to help spread the word. If you have learned or been inspired by something you heard on this podcast, chances are others would too. Please consider sharing your favorite episode with your network on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram. Thanks for listening. We're glad you're here.
What are you observing these past, I don't know, 16, 17 months in the business impact of COVID? And what are some of your predictions, perhaps, on the future of cultures and how these businesses are going to function?
Again, a micro and a macro kind of answer, because I do believe, or maybe it's just because of the way my mind works the way it does, but we always have parallel processes. So maybe we should start with the macro this time. To me, the COVID pandemic has been very much like stepping into a time machine. Not me personally, but if we take a look at planet Earth, in that some of the trends that we saw prior to the pandemic have definitely been accelerated by it, digitization being the most obvious one. All the stuff we had been talking about during the last one or two decades suddenly happened. We were forced to it. So from that point of view, I guess necessity is indeed the mother of innovation. So we are now doing things like this. It was a little bit difficult in the beginning. I still do my speeches. It's different to give a speech over the internet, because you're basically lecturing to a wall of whipped cream. you spit out your sentences and it goes, because there's not this interaction anymore. But it's a whole lot better than nothing. So I think digitization, and in all likelihood, this is going to leave a big mark on business and our private lives also in the years to come. I mean, just 2 years ago, it would have been unimaginable, unless you were extremely nerdy, to have a dinner with your best friends over the computer. I mean, you would have been treated like the village idiot, basically, by everyone you know. But if digitization was the big accelerating thing here, globalization, which has been the second big trend, if we go back the last 50 years or so, globalization has come not to a halt. And of course, given that some of the Asian economies were hit to a much lesser extent by the pandemic for various reasons, this shift towards the East, in terms of where we find the center of the world economy, has probably been accelerated. But in general, globalization can easily become deglobalization. And in some ways, it already has started to become that. But was it something that was triggered by the pandemic? In all likelihood, not, because the big game changer for that was probably the financial crisis, when demand dropped to the extent that it did, if we go back to those days. And in addition to that, the ongoing trade discussions, debates, fights between the Trump administration and China in particular, and also the embargo with regard to Russia and the Russian economy after Ukraine in particular. So we're seeing, I guess, mixed things happening on this macro level. Some things are going much faster. Some things are going much slower. If we look at the corporate world, I have a couple of worries. One worry I have is that we have, if not a lost generation, we have the people who could not really enter into an organization where you're supposed to have a creative role because you only entered it digitally. And I think so much of the creative things and the creative work that we do, you can do over the internet, but you need to have this social capital, this Mick Jagger and Keith Richards thing that I was talking about. Unless you have that shared level of tacit knowledge, it's going to be very difficult for people to improvise. I also worry about the fact that so many interesting things happen almost by epiphany. I mean, it's the spontaneous meeting in a corridor or by a coffee machine or in an elevator where you meet someone who you were not supposed to meet. And if you take a look at most meetings we have on the internet right now, they are good meetings. Because I was always worried about, and maybe this is a Swedish phenomenon, the lack of discipline in meetings. So many people showed up unprepared, they had not gone through the material, and you spent basically the first half of a meeting just explaining to people the kind of stuff that they should already know. It doesn't happen to the extent that it used to do when you do meetings over the internet or using Zoom or Teams or Cisco or any of those things. But the really interesting stuff, the magical stuff, the non-scripted stuff, so to speak, We need to find that arena again. And I think we are social creatures. So finding this balance between how much of the good stuff from the past should we try to go back to, and how much of the good stuff from all the things that happened when we accelerated digitization do we need? Not the least, since as an effect of digitization, and in particular AI and machine learning, so many traditional jobs will be replaced in the years to come. I mean, I've seen some studies that suggest that using existing technology only, and of course we will not stop technological development, about half of all the jobs in the US economy will be gone during the next 30 years or so. So we're going to see a lot of job destruction. And we need to be creative when it comes to job creation. And that will, I think, be very much a question about how we will organize work in the years to come.
So as a highly creative person, what are the industries that you think will be, you know, will come out of this creative destruction, the new industries, the new jobs? What are your predictions around that?
Well, sometimes I was, when I did research, I was called a futurist. Which is really weird when you do research, because research is based on facts, and there are very few facts about the future. The future is a little bit like death. No one has come back with a completely reliable report yet. Well, let's put it like this. My dad, who's retired since 15 years, he worked as a, I think you called it in English, a traffic inspector, you know, the guy who hands you your license when you've passed the test. And given that it's a pandemic kind of thing, I talked to him more or less every day. And we've talked about his work life and how it was like growing up. And I mean, in all these conversations. And it got me thinking about what kind of skills did he need? Well, he needed to know a little bit about psychology, because most people are kind of nervous when they take this test. He also needed to know languages, because already back then, Sweden was a fairly sort of multicultural place and not everyone spoke Swedish, so English was mandatory. I think it was probably a pretty good idea if he knew the traffic rules and regulations. That was sort of probably a few other things as well. But think about the situation in 10 years' time, when someone or someone needs to hand a driver's license, not to a person, but to a self-automated vehicle. I mean, what kind of skills will be necessary? Well, you know, you need to know about programming. You need to know algorithms. You need to know mechanics and physics and all of that stuff. So for sure, someone still needs to decide. I'm not sure it's going to be a human being, though. Is this car safe? Can we let it drive around on our roads? But that something or someone will need a very, very different skill set compared to the one my dad wanted. So I would say two directions here. Something that is very manual and very tied to a particular location. A hairdresser. I mean, most people will not go to Thailand. I mean, maybe if you're Jennifer Lopez or one of these big football stars, you will go to your favorite hairdresser in Hollywood, although you live in London. But most people will not do that. And I think most people, maybe with some exceptions in Asia, where they have a tendency to interact with technology in a different way than most people in the West, most people would not fancy going to a robot that will cut your hair. Not that I need to think about cutting my hair anymore, so that's not an issue.
I was going to say, I would like a robot to shave my head.
But that is sort of one direction. Things that are stuck geographically. Things where it would make little sense for us to use technology to apply to this particular problem that you're trying to solve. But the other direction would probably be the extreme to the other end. I mean, you will have to sit down and do the algorithms and program this machine. And maybe the third one is to become this you manager, for the lack of a better word, right? Where you basically work with evoking emotions, providing inspiration, motivation, and you don't have to be an expert or anything like that, because you're more like a coach and a good soccer team. There's a fantastic story, and I don't know if it's true, but I think it was Juventus, the Italian football team. In the 1960s, they got a new coach, and he had never been a good player, and he had coached a couple of minor teams in the first division in Italy, and he replaced a legendary coach who had played for Juventus for 10 years. He had been on the national team. And the journalist, during his first press conference, questioned him constantly. Hey, you never played in national team. And how do you suppose? And I mean, you can. And then eventually he looked at them and he said, you know what? You don't have to be a good horse to become a good jockey. So I think this you manager, perhaps the Oprah Winfrey kind of leader, where you basically provide a platform and you make sure that every voice of dissent can make themselves heard. I think, in fact, we're seeing some of that already. A great quote that I picked up, and I think it was a Gary Hamel interview with the guy who used to be CEO of Google. I think he's chairman now, Eric Schmidt. And he got the question, what was your span of control when you were running Google? And he said, 60 people. I had 60 direct reports. And Gary goes, what, 60? Why? Well, Eric Schmidt says, if you get enough direct reports, then you can't manage them. That was the goal. So on purpose, he put himself in a position in which it would be impossible for him to manage Google in a traditional way. Now, why did he do it? Well, I think, at least in part, because he's smart enough to realize that he isn't smart enough in a world in which we're all becoming increasingly stupid to formulate all the relevant questions or to hold all the critical answers to the questions that will determine the future of a company like Google. Now, it didn't mean that he couldn't be a leader, but instead of stamping out deviance, which I think management was very much a case of during the previous century, primarily negative deviants. But if we killed a couple of deviants, that was a sacrifice that we were willing to make. Instead, I think he realized that, yes, I have to be this master of ceremonies for a debate, a discussion. And as a leader, I also have to make sure that it's a debate with a deadline. So yes, meritocracy, but at some point in time, you also need to step in and secure action.
So just come back to this point you made earlier on about the last competitive advantage of man. And I took from that, you know, it's the human qualities of sense-making, decision-making, relationships, emotional intelligence, all of the kind of inherent qualities that AI will in our lifetimes at least, not be able to replicate. How does that stack up in terms of the organizational priorities of leaders today, in your estimation? Where do you see people getting this right?
Again, perhaps this is a bit of an abstract answer. I don't know, but you can definitely see, and if you look at academic research and you try to see who becomes leader at what point in time, you can see an interesting trend. Because if we go back a few hundred years to when the limited company was a new thing, who were the leaders in companies? Well, mostly lawyers, because the flows that truly mattered back then were the legal flows. We started to write contracts and all of that stuff. So that became critical. And the institution was brand new. We didn't know exactly how to deal with it. Then industrialization, the second wave of industrialization, becomes so important with electrification. The most important flows are technological flows. Where do you find the CEOs? Well, they're engineers. They have a Master of Science degree because they control knowledge with regard to the most critical resource. Then numbers, finance, access to capital, the financial capital that you need in order to expand your business becomes a big thing. Where do you find the managers? MBAs, and the growth of the entire MBA industry throughout the world. I mean, you still have lawyers. You still have a lot of engineers, especially in heavy industries, and you have MBAs. But if human beings become, and managing flows of ideas and emotions between human beings become the big thing, well, maybe it's psychologists, anthropologists, sociologists, people who understand human interaction. Or perhaps we should think like this. Do you have in your management team those who can deal with the legal issues, those who understand the technological issues, those who understand finance? Probably. Let's have someone or a few who understand human interactions. And if you put all that stuff together, maybe leadership in the years to come is not a process for a single leader. Maybe it's a process for an entire team where you have to use the strengths and leverage those strengths of different human beings as you go through different phases of your organizational development. I think leaders are dealers in hope. I think it was Napoleon who once put it like that. Mm. The day when business organizations understand what I think already most religious organizations, most sports organizations, most musicians, most artists understand, then we'll see some true magic happen. And I do believe that the best companies already do understand it. Is there a risk that you create a cult? For sure. But so long as I prefer tribe, because tribes need to be inclusive. In a tribe, you need to coexist with everything around you. Otherwise, the tribe eventually will die. And this is exactly what happens to most cults over time. So the tribal thing to me is important. And while historically most of those tribes were geographically structured, the new tribes that you can create in a business, they don't need to follow geography at all. They can be much more biographical, or if you include customers, biographical with B-U-Y rather than B-I-O. So I think in terms of tribes, I think that truly makes sense. And then there needs to be a reason, a purpose that acts as an anchor, the glue that basically brings that organization together.
What are you working on now? What's the thing that you're really interested in?
I'm actually working on a children's book.
Really?
Some cynical British friends of mine pointed out when I told them a while back that I'm writing a children's book that that's what you've been doing all along, Jonas. I probably, because my kids have now moved out, they're in their 20s. And I started to think about when we went on trips when they were really young, and you realized that, geez, I've forgotten to bring any book. on board because the book is in the luggage that we checked in. You had either the in-flight magazine or you had this little pamphlet where the mother is told to put on her oxygen mask before putting it on the child. And so I started to write stories about the child, or at least I started telling stories to my kids about this child, and it sort of evolved into a, I guess in English his name would be Fabian the Mischief. So I'm thinking about putting some of those stories together. I don't know if it will ever be published, but it would be a great gift to give to my kids eventually when they turn 30 or so.
That would be very cool.
I'm not thinking in terms of writing a new business book right now. For me, I mean, Fast Forward is not that old. And I need to come out and meet people again and do interviews, do speeches, have dinners with people and get back into that information collection mode kind of thing. But I want that information to be unique. I want it to be personal, which has been difficult during the last 15 to 16 months. It's the stories, the hidden stories and the secrets that you want to put into a book, not the obvious stuff that you can get off the web.
What have you done during the last 18 months that you wouldn't have done otherwise? That's been really good.
I've tried to play guitar, but I wouldn't say that it's been good. Neither would my neighbors, by the way. I think they're more thinking about it in terms of, is he killing a cat or whatever? I actually started horse breeding about 4 years ago. I met a new woman, and I've always been a bit afraid of horses because they're kind of big, and I'm not entirely sure that they are grass eaters. They may munch up a little guy as well. No, we breed dressage horses, so we've had a lot of time to spend with the horses because, and it's also been sort of a sanctuary to get out of the apartment, to get out of the city, and we have the horses about an hour and a half drive from Stockholm. So I think I've become hopefully a better discussion partner for my partner when it comes to deciding what stallions to use when we in our breeding program.
That's really cool. Well, thank you, Yannis, for coming on. We really appreciate your time and insights. This has been fantastic.
Yannis, thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight.
A pleasure for me as well. Thank you, guys.
So if you haven't already, be sure to pick up a copy of Funky Business and Fast Forward. And until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?